honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 98-year-old Dan Doherty of Fairfield, California. Perhaps he was your insurance agent once upon a time in Marin County. By now, you've gotten a feel for what a terrific storyteller Dan is. And if you're one of those folks who likes to talk sports and you ever have the privilege of meeting Dan and his wife, Norma, maybe you should ask him about the Major League Baseball game he and some fellow GIs witnessed just before shipping off to war, the Brooklyn Dodgers visiting the Boston Braves. Or maybe he'll tell you about the time after the war, while playing basketball for Carleton College in his native Minnesota, he held a future Basketball Hall of Famer scoreless. But in order to do that, Dan had to survive some trying times in the European theater as a BAR gunner in two different infantry divisions.
It's interesting. When I got transferred from the 44th to the 45th, when we went into combat, they took our duffel bags and stored them, because you couldn't take all that stuff with you. And so when I got transferred, I said to myself, wow, I'm never going to see that duffel bag again. And I had two cameras in there. In March, we had 2 weeks of training in Alsace for crossing rivers, the Rhine, and attacking pillboxes, the Siegfried Line. I had learned somewhere along the way that our bags, duffel bags, were stored in Sarrebourg, France. So I got permission to hitchhike to Sarrebourg. It wasn't very far away. Hitchhike meant you rode some military vehicle over there. And I found the warehouse with one guard, and he's guarding thousands of bags of the 44th Division, and I have nothing to explain to him who I am. I just walk in and say, I was with the 44th, and I'm now with the 45th. I'd like to get my back. Sure, soldier. It took me 3 hours to convince him. I finally said, you get the bag, and I will tell you everything that's in that bag. And so he found the bag and opened it up, and everything was in there, the two cameras and everything else. And so I got my bag, got the two cameras. When you're transferred in the middle of the war from one division to another, it's pretty drastic.
Well, did those cameras end up coming in handy?
Yeah, I couldn't carry them with me. So I had my, there wasn't much in the duffel bag at that point, but the cameras. And I gave it to our kitchen crew. And I said, please carry this. Whenever the kitchen crew was around, which wasn't very often, it's only happened twice. I got the camera out and took pictures, and I've got a lot of pictures taken in April 8th, 9th, and 10th. And we hit Nuremberg on the 15th, Dachau on the 29th, Munich on the 30th. And so just 2 weeks before, I got a great picture of our whole platoon. And then once in Munich after the war, of course, I took a lot of pictures. But otherwise, I only had it on two occasions when we were taking breaks. And I still have one of the cameras over there. It's a little Argus candid camera. The other one was stolen while I was on furlough in Paris. It was a nice Kodak, really good camera. The good pictures I took were with that Kodak.
Well, and I know we're going to end up at Dachau, and you've shared with so many people your experiences there that you're one of the last people who can tell those stories. But I'm curious, in the months that you had with the 44th and then your combat with the 45th, are there some moments you look back on and you say, you know, that was a pretty close call. I came closer to adding to my family's Gold Star legacy than I wanted to.
Yeah. Well, in the 44th division, the whole danger was artillery. And we would get shelled a lot. In those days, what we had for sleeping was a blanket and a shelter half. And you rolled up the shelter half and with the blanket, and you wore it on your back. And one night, I unrolled it, and there was a piece of shrapnel had gone right through the shelter half. So that was about the closest that I came to really, I got hit in the Siegfried line, but that was a very minor thing compared to that other one. But we had some bad days in the 44th from artillery. We had one was called Purple Heart Hill because just we got hit big shelling when we were on a hillside and a lot of people got hit. But there were two different experiences because the combat with the 44th and October through January, 44 through 45, that was a really cold winter foxhole weather. From January to May, it was a pretty much a totally different experience. You were constantly on the move. Snow was no longer a problem. You didn't dig a lot of foxholes, but you'd go from one battle to the next. So it was two different kinds of warfare. Bunched up.
Well, and you tell us about, you know, finding the hole that the shrapnel put in your shelter half and later on getting wounded yourself. But along the way, in both the 44th and 45th, I'm sure you're seeing casualties and guys that you had spent some time with are getting killed or wounded. How did you, as such a young man, how did you handle that, process that?
Well, I guess it helps if you're young. I don't recall it being a big problem. Somebody would get hit and then you didn't see, and most of the time they would never come back. But occasionally they would go to the hospital and then mend and then come on back. But you would be getting replacements, so there'd be new people to know and meet. I think the fact that you're young is why they're having you, why you have you there. It was tougher for the married guys. Yeah, they were getting letters from home and stuff, and most of us were about 19 and single. A lot of them had come out of pretty sad situations in the Depression. A lot of them had been in the CCC, Conservation Corps. I remember I had a watch that we used over and over for guard duty. The reason we did was most people didn't have watches coming out of the 30s. And my parents had given me one, and it was a totally different situation than when you have all the prosperity that you have today. I remember the Depression very well. My dad had a good job all during the war. He was either working for a bank or a meatpacking company, but there were people across the street, and there was a doctor, and his patients would come and pull up and leave things at the back door. They'd leave produce and eggs and stuff. They were paying for their medical expenses. And I remember in the 30s, my mother had a rug for sale. I guess she put a want ad in the paper or something. I think it was a living room rug, and I think she was going to charge $3 for it. And a lady came over to look at it, and she came in our house and saw this lovely furnished living room and started crying. And my mother ended up giving her the rug because she had nothing. So it was a tough time. And then all of a sudden you have this whole huge effort to mobilize for war.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because as you said, you know, today's generations don't have any idea what that's like, and I hope never do. And you mentioned getting hit at the Siegfried line, and you said that's not a big deal, but I want our listeners to hear it so they can make their own conclusions about it.
In the middle of March, about March 15th, the entire Western Front moved into Germany. Germany had built their defensive line, the Siegfried line, opposite the Maginot line in France. All of a sudden on March 18th, we're with tanks and we're moving forward, and we come, then here is the Siegfried line. There's this huge ditch. It's about 15 to 12 feet deep, and about that across, so the tanks can't go past it. And on the other side, there's cement cones that you see, rows of them, and barbed wire. That stopped the tanks, and so we just went down into the ditch and came up on the other side, the infantry, and started attacking the pillboxes. And the tanks behind us were just blasting away at the pillboxes that they could see. But it was very deep. It went for miles back into Germany. Well, it was going quite well. And then all of it was in very heavy woods, our section. And all of a sudden, the mother of all artillery barrages lands on us. The Germans know right where we are. When you are shelled in heavy wood, you get a lot of tree bursts. Mm-hmm. And so there's shrapnel coming from everywhere. And we had 36 casualties in that morning. I'm walking along and I kind of am stunned a little bit on the left foot. I wasn't even sure I had been hit, but I sat down in the middle of the Siegfried line and took off my boot. And sure enough, right at the ball of the sole of the foot, there was a slit. And then I had two pairs of socks on, and right at the ball of the socks, on the ball of the foot, there was a slit in the things. And then it's very hard to see the bottom of your the ball of your, but I could see that there was a little blood there. So, but there wasn't any pain. But if you get hit, you're supposed to go back. And so there was a guy laying on the ground moaning. If you got hit, you were supposed to take your 12 sulfa pills. Sulfa had come out, and that's what they did for antibiotics. And so I went over to him and I said, have you taken your sulfa pills? And he said, no. And I said, finally said, well, where were you hit? I rolled him over. He'd been hit in the stomach. Mm. Well, if you got hit in the stomach, you weren't supposed to take the sulfa pills. So I said, oh, we'll skip that. He was one of the fatalities, thing. And I started walking back, and then there was a Jeep, and I got in the Jeep, and there were two or three other guys. One of them was a GI just bawling his head off, and he wasn't wounded. He was an identical twin, and his brother had been wounded, and he just collapsed. And the Army's practice usually was to separate twins just because of that, but they had insisted on serving together. And when his brother got hit, I discovered in the morning report afterwards that he probably just spent a night in the battalion aid station and went back. His brother survived the war. I mean, he was badly wounded, never came back. But that fellow was eventually killed in the Aschaffenburg. I go to the battalion aid station, and the guy, medic says, hey, you got a $1 million wound. You got this war made. The next day, I'm in a field hospital, and I'm on a gurney, and the nurse anesthetist comes over to administer the sodium pentothal. And I said to her, now, I want that shrapnel. She said, sure, soldier. Well, I wake up and there's no shrapnel. So they give me the Purple Heart, and I have my two socks with a slit in them, and I wrap it around the Purple Heart, and I go over to the Red Cross tent, and I said, I want to mail this home. Sure, soldier. Well, they mail it home without the socks. So I can't even find the scar, and I have no evidence. But I have the Purple Heart. It was worth 5 points to get discharged. Well, to show you how bad it was, I was wounded in the foot, and on the second day in the hospital, I played ping pong. Mm-hmm. So you can see this thing. And somebody saw me, and that was it. And I was out of there. I regretted afterwards that I should have played part of the act better, because I was on my way back to the front. I was the first one back of the guys who had been hit. Mm-hmm. I got back on April 2nd. I was wounded on March 18th. That's about as quick as you can do it, because it's a process of going through replacement depots, one after another, and you just move when they move you. And I came back, and we had gone into the Siegfried line at absolutely full strength, which in a platoon was three squads of 12 guys plus two sergeants. That's 38, plus an officer, which is 39. I made it count 13 when I got back. Wow. Our company had just been decimated, and there are six officers in a rifle company. Five of them had been casualties that day. Mm-hmm. And there were six sergeants in our platoon. One sergeant was not a casualty. He became platoon sergeant. And I came back and resumed being a squad leader. I came back and discovered that they had been fighting for a week at Aschaffenburg. Aschaffenburg is near Frankfurt on the Main River. And when the 45th Division was approaching it, they expected to find white sheets hanging out of the windows because Patton's army had already announced they'd taken Aschaffenburg, which meant their tanks came to it, went around, and went going. Unbeknownst to everybody, a colonel had rounded up 5,000 German troops and dug them in and said, "You will defend Aschaffenburg," with the threat of death. Anybody who called in sick got hung. Well, the 45th discovered they were on a, had a real battle on their hands. It took a week. I came back the last 2 days of that. Our company had, had 23 more casualties at Aschaffenburg. So between the Siegfried Line and Aschaffenburg, what happened within a two-week period, they'd lost about 60 men, which is a lot of guys. And then it gave us a three-day break early in April. Then we resume hiking, and on April 15th, we end up at Nuremberg, and we have it surrounded, three divisions, the 42nd Division, the 3rd Division, and the 45th. Anybody but Hitler had been in charge, they would have surrendered the city. Instead, they defended it, and so the first day, we just sat on the bluffs and watched the Army Air Corps planes routinely dive bomb the city over and over again all day long. When we left Nuremberg, it was just total rubble. I've got pictures of it. There's just nothing standing. 4 days later, the three divisions, in effect, met in the center of town, and that was the 20th of April. To find a place to sleep that night, we had to hike all the way back out into the suburbs to find a building that was standing. And we got a day or two of rest, and then they dispatched the 45th and the 42nd Division towards Munich.
And it was along that journey that Dan Doherty would encounter the awful realities of the Dachau concentration camp, a chapter of history that he has dedicated much of his golden years to preserving and articulating. And that's what we're going to explore next time on Hometown Heroes. You can link to photos and more information relating to Dan's story at hometownheroesradio.com. And don't miss the rest of his story next week, from what he saw at Dachau to the connections that have ensued to why he feels it's so important to tell the story. Before we sign off today, I'd like to thank longtime listeners Kevin and Bea Olson for connecting me with Dan, one of their Pleasant Valley Estates neighbors in Fairfield, California. And thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, inviting you to join us again next time for the rest of Dan Doherty's remarkable story, which will once again reinforce those four words we finish with each and every week: freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.